Hey, Mac, when does deer season start?
Well, if you want the best deer herd possible, Lanny, you need to start right now.
Right now.
That's why we're starting our promotion. I mean, we've got a Deer Season Starts Now promotion on plantbiologic.com where you can pick up our Game Changer soybeans, our forage soybeans, and our spring protein peas. While you're there, you might as well go ahead and pick up some brassicas like our final forage and winter bowls.
Yeah, stock up for the cool season planting right now. Listeners to the GK Podcast, if you use coupon code GKPOD, you can save an additional 10% off our entire selection of warm season, cool season, and clover food plot seed. Get started today and visit plantbiologic.com for an unforgettable fall.
I am Jeff Foxworthy, and welcome to Gamekeeper Podcast. If you want to learn more about farming for wildlife and habitat management, then buddy, you are in the right place. Join the Gamekeeper crew direct from Mossy Oak Land Enhancement Studio as they discuss the latest wildlife and habitat management practices, news, and of course, hunting. There's no telling what you'll learn, but I'm going to tell you, I bet it's interesting. Enjoy.
We're live in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome, everybody. Once again, West Point, Mississippi, home of Mossy Oak Camo, the Gamekeeper Studio. We got a lot to talk about today. It's going to be
talking
really
about turkeys, though. It's going to go by fast.
Yeah, the suspension is building.
It is daily.
The countdown is on. The
youth season starts 1 week from yesterday. No, today.
The time this airs, it'll be brought upon us. But it is officially March 2024. As of this morning.
Yeah, we had to go through that long February.
Yeah. It was a doozy, wasn't it? 29.
And for about the 15th year in a row, we have an early spring.
Yeah. Is it 15 in a row?
I mean, that's when I started noticing it. But, you look at your old pictures with the red buds blooming in the background from opening weekend of turkey season. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? We're 2 weeks away from that, and the red buds are already in full bloom. Mm-hmm. So.
I've got a new word for you, Lanny.
Oh.
Antler exodus.
Instead of antler genesis?
Are y'all seeing any sheds yet?
We're going to look this weekend, actually, if saw it with Toxie.
No.
I'm watching my Spartan cameras every day, and I'm still seeing all the antlers on my box.
We found one shed.
Yeah, at the lease.
So last weekend, since you asked... just out of the blue, Diane said, "Hey, we got all three granddaughters. Let's go to the cabin." And we got out there, and then like immediately, let's go riding. Well, Clay had gotten the Clarices from there, had brought them in to service them. There was nothing left but the Argo that we duck hunt in, so we just got in that,
fired it up,
and went off in the water. They were just thrilled, we were riding across where I'd burned one of those big fields off. Diane's, wait, what's that? I see an antler. So it was a really big shed. And so, let's find some more. So, I rode around to the planted fields around the cabin. They found like 9 sheds.
Oh, man.
And they were like, it was so much fun because Evie, the oldest, is 8, 9. She would be like, I see one. And she'd bounce out of that Argo and bounce across that field.
First.
Even if it was a little small one, she could eagle eye them. So, I sat back even if I saw one, didn't claim it. It was so much fun. Now, how can you count on finding them with them? I don't know. But you to can. Take your granddaughters out and let them find sheds was very cool.
I've never found 9.
We found the matching, the big one that we found. It was actually a 12 point. We went around the creek. We were down on the side of the creek. That's the one she saw first and went on to where that big, the test plot field is.
Yeah.
And sure enough, there was other matching side laying right across the creek from it. Yeah. Believe it or not. I'm not been great luck finding sheds, but that was a pretty cool
thing. It's a good year.
Yeah, it's a good year.
Look at those creek crossings because they're jumping and landing and in thickets and trails in there and field edges.
Walk the trails. Far and few between as a good food plot was this year with that drought and all. You're going to find a lot of them there.
Yeah.
Mac,
you
need to do that with Wilkes now. That'd be a lot of fun for y'all.
Oh, yeah. You'd have a blast.
I thought we were going, Mac, but maybe we're not. You're welcome to go with us if he does let us go.
Well, thank you. Please. Yeah,
no problem. Oh, my gosh. They guilt me about everything.
So I've got one other thing. We need to, Lanny, I kind of got started the other day saying how I got to experience how the other half lives with Toxie. So the end of the story
that's
is
so pitiful.
So the Friday night at the NWTF, that big fancy place, he and I go to supper at the Waffle House.
Yeah.
We did.
It was delicious.
I love the Waffle House.
It's what we do. We ate at the Waffle House.
Yeah.
Somebody, some turkey hunter there, picked up our tab. And I just wanted to say, I hope they're listening. And say thank you.
Yeah. Wow. So, random act of turkey hunting kindness.
Nobody has ever picked up my tab. It had to be for Toxie.
Oh.
Because usually people leave a tab for me to pick up.
Should I have worn my bullseye shirt today?
They probably heard you had a wedding to pay for. It's probably what it was.
Could have been what it was.
They did. Maybe, yeah. You started your GoFundMe yet?
Not yet.
Man, if I knew y'all's tab was going to get picked up, I wouldn't have eaten at Old Hickory that night.
Well, thanks to whoever did that.
That was really nice.
It was nice. So, guys, today, at the Bottomland Book Club, this gentleman comes up and grabs me and he says, I got somebody you got to meet, you got to talk to. So the guy that came and grabbed me was Mr. Steve Rawson, which is a hard name to say.
Rawson
is a hard name to pronounce.
Yeah, it's more like Rawson.
Rawson.
There you
okay.
go. There you go.
Like Rawson. The son of Ross.
Yeah.
Rawson. So he said, I got somebody you got to meet. He said, Mr. Benny Hill. He lives there in Mississippi. Who is Benny Hill?
I don't know.
He's like a televangelist.
Well, let me tell you what.
He's a British comedian.
You have a running record of name butchering for the past
few weeks. Well, Mr. Benny Herring is here. He is an evangelist. He's just a turkey evangelist.
That's right. Okay. All right. So, Mr. Benny Herring, I'm so sorry. I apologize.
No problem.
He was born with that problem.
Yeah. It happens every week.
It really does happen more often than I care to admit. But he was explaining you were maybe one of, if not the first biologist to work with turkeys in the state and trapping and translocating them. And we're just so excited to have you here and to learn about this.
Well, you don't know how much I appreciate that. And I was not the first. I was fortunate enough to be in a position. We had a turkey biologist. This was the Game and Fish. This is back in the 60s, guys.
Wow.
And we had a turkey biologist that was in charge of the turkey project, and his name was Champ Clark, and unfortunately, he lost his life on a tractor and disc on one of our wildlife management areas.
Oh, man.
And as a result of his demise, I was in line to inherit the turkey project work, and I had been working with Champ a lot. We spent a lot of time in Florida learning how to use alpha chlorose to capture turkeys. And I was in the right place at the right time, Bobby.
Yeah. Wow. What was that?
It's a drug that you use on turkeys. We never used it because using a drug when you're capturing a lot of turkeys is very difficult because all of them don't take in the same amount, and it affects the size of the turkey. It affects them differently. And consequently, you probably would lose a few of them because they'd wander off. So we never used it except one time. And, of course, the cannon net was what was developed in the late 50s for waterfowl capture originally. So we thought, why can't we catch turkeys with it? And that's what we went to. And, you might lose one or two out of a bunch that you had baited up to catch, but very seldom did you lose any of them. So it was very effective, and that's the reason we were able from the 70s to the 80s to make such an impact on moving so many turkeys is because of cannon nets. And fortunately, now we did some restocking in the late 50s. We had a few birds on the Leaf River Wildlife Management area in South Mississippi, and we caught a few turkeys there and transported. Located them, but the main source of turkeys from the 70s to the 80s came from a place in Cahoma County, Mississippi, Friars Point. And there was a family of people there, the McKees, that were generous enough to set aside 3,000 acres of land behind the Mississippi River levee that had abundance of turkeys. And they set it up as a wildlife refuge, and we captured over 90 releases of turkey off of that refuge.
Wow.
And there was one man involved in that I would like to tell you his name and make sure you remember it. There was a game warden. At that time, we called him game warden. Now we call him conservation officers. But he was a conservation officer that lived in Cahoma County, and his name was Wayne Strider. And he knew turkeys. He understood turkeys. And when the deer season was over, we got Wayne to start baiting and trapping turkeys for us. And I was fortunate enough to become good friends with him and be willing to get up at 1 o'clock in the morning and drive over there and help him set up his cannon nets and catch turkeys. And we carried turkeys all over the state of Mississippi from Friars Point Refuge due to the McKee family. Just wanted you to know that.
That people is know so cool.
Sound the horns for the McKee family.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, and God bless the cannon net. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I got chill bumps thinking about what's happened because of people like you and that.
How generous was that of that family?
No doubt about it.
To allow that.
I think my family was at the island next door, Jackson Point, hunting turkeys, not giving them away.
Well, we were also fortunate enough later on, a few of the hunting clubs like Catfish Point.
Mm-hmm. That's south of there.
That's where ours came from.
Yeah. And they begin to say, okay, we've got an abundance of turkeys. Y'all come catch a release here. So not all of the turkeys, we didn't do all of our trapping at Friars Point. We trapped all up and down the river. A lot of private individuals around Columbia, Mississippi, allowed us to catch birds there and transplant. But now it wasn't as easy. We had a procedure that we went through before we would approve a place to carry a release of turkeys. We would have a biologist to go and examine the area that requested them. And back then, our rule was that you had to have a minimum of 10,000 acres of good habitat with everybody, clubs, or individual landowners being in agreement that they would protect those birds.
Hmm.
And then they would be put on a release list. And that's the way we did it. And then we tried to, we never could come to an exact number, but we would like to put at least 10 hens and 2 to 5 gobblers at each release site. And then we would use various methods to track the reproductive success. We would use mail carriers to tell us where they saw turkeys, how many they saw, what they were.
Yep.
Conservation officers would tell us, landowners would tell us. And our standard was that 5 years, if things looked good, you could have a limited gobbler season.
Hmm.
And it worked out great.
Tell them about how y'all tagged them with the different colors.
Originally, of course, we put leg bands on every one of them, every turkey we released. And you would get a return occasionally of those. But so we thought, well, you know, we've got to have a way to identify those turkeys if you see them. So we begin to put different colored markers on their wings, red, yellow, whatever, and we kept a record of, okay, we put 10 hens with yellow, we put 3 gobblers with red. And then if somebody saw one of them, we would know where they were released and where they came from.
Hmm.
So that was a big help. And that time, we did not have radio telemetry like we do now. But as Mississippi State, they begin to use radio telemetry to put on turkeys. And, of course, you learn just so much about a turkey using telemetry.
That was another pioneer, Dr. George Hurst.
Exactly.
He's the man.
Yes, sir.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Gosh, it's interesting to kind of travel back in time. So this is in the 70s when this got started.
I lived through it. It was amazing.
So there were actually counties around or areas that might not have any turkeys in them at all.
Exactly.
And so
lots of them.
It would be a group of people like a Mr. Fox that would communicate with the down Jackson way and say, we'd like to do this.
Well, that's what we did. Acres. We had to go through that process. He got signatures from either landowners or club presidents to get collectively 10,000 acres.
Yeah. And they would request a turkey release.
Yep.
And that's when we'd go and look at the property, and if it met the requirements, we put it on the list. Yep.
And then y'all would do this in the cooler months, the winter months, and release them in, say, January and February?
Our capture period was most of the time from mid-January to 1st of March. That was kind of our trapping period. And then we would, of course, carry them and release them and begin to keep track of them as best we could. And, our basic rule was 5 years, hopefully we can have a short turkey season. That was our aim.
He said about 2 weeks.
about all the turkey season was, 2 weeks.
Yeah, that was our original recommendation, start and have 2 weeks, you know.
Was that in the, was it regulated by county, or did, I mean, just, they would just have a season specifically for that county?
At that time, like some counties that had had turkeys for several years, they may have 3 or 4 week season.
Oh.
But a new county, so to speak, say like Itala County, we opened it in 1970, and it was 2 weeks. Montgomery Carroll opened a year later. It was two weeks.
How many turkey hunters did they have in Itala County the first year?
Four of us.
Wow. Man. Y'all ought to see the set of spurs on this table.
Yeah. Oh, for the good old days.
Yeah.
And I still bet they didn't talk to each other.
Yeah, they still wouldn't tell each other anything.
Lanny has more than four people parked at his spot he goes to on the core
every time.
Tell them about when you found tracks.
The way we scouted is that the four of us, we would take a county road. And we would ride and look for tracks. Mm-hmm. And if we saw tracks, we'd get out and break off a pine limb and wipe those tracks
there
out
it
so
is.
Nobody else could find them.
After my own
no
heart.
No doubt about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, when turkey season opened, of course, we'd go there and listen.
Yeah. Some things never change.
You know, on that same topic, I can remember as a kid when my Uncle Jack Cottrell, he had a group called the Rockin' Chair Fox Hunters, pretty famous group of old men. They would take their dogs and listen to them run foxes. But anyway, they saw a deer track. And when they came back into town at the barbershop and at the restaurant, all they were talking, that a group of people rode out, a crowd, to look at the deer track.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe it. We've come a long way.
There he was.
Your daughter's been begging you to hunt since her little brother shot the big 8 last year. You've ran a fire, dissed the fields, got stuck, got unstuck. Planted food plots, fertilized, and prayed for rain. You moved trees, limbed roads, even bought one of those fancy cell cameras.
So what's your excuse?
LS Tractor.
Moultrie has pioneered the game management category. Today, Moultrie is one of the best-selling brands of feeders and seeders in the world, and they continue to innovate with new technology that gamekeepers will rely on. Moultrie products are always field-tested and designed for hunters by hunters, combining forward-thinking innovation with time-tested practicality. Moultrie, first in feeders since 1979. All right, so guys, Moultrie is offering our listeners a 15% site-wide discount at MoultrieFeeders.com. Use code MossyOak with a capital M, MossyOak, at MoultrieFeeders.com and get that 15% discount. Yeah. So when did you start with the conservation department?
I'll give you a little history on my education. Of course, I graduated from Kilmichael High School. And from there, I knew my mother wanted me to be a school teacher. Bless her heart. So she insisted that I go to Delta State College at that time. It's university now, to become a school teacher. So I did. I went to Delta State, and I majored in biology. But I figured out right quick that I really didn't care anything about teaching, but I really loved to hunt and fish.
Mm-hmm.
About the time I graduated from Delta State with a degree in biology, I found out that there was a wildlife school at Mississippi State University. So I went up there and talked to Dr. Arner, and he lined me up a little scholarship, and I went to Mississippi State, and I graduated from there with a degree in wildlife management in 1967, May.
Wow, that is awesome.
And the latter part of May, I was hired by the Mississippi Game and Fish at that time, and I went to work for them, and I worked for them for 32 years. And following when I retired at 56, I went to work as a consulting biologist with the Endangered Species Consulting Company, and I worked for them 11 years. And then I retired. And I say I retired. I still work for a couple of guys that own some property in Carroll County. I still do their wildlife work.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. That's awesome.
So you've seen a lot of changes.
You've been gamekeeping a long time.
I have.
Mm-hmm. So how many releases
I have a record of we made 90 releases from the Friars Point Refuge.
Wow. That in and to itself is amazing.
So and that would be at least 5 to 10 birds every time.
Well, 10 to 15.
So yeah. When you multiply that out,
thousands, over 1,000 for sure.
So that's amazing. We've made releases, and I've been personally involved with releases from Catfish Point, mm-hmm. Miller Point, a couple of clubs down through there. The individuals in Columbia, Mississippi had a place he lets us trap, and I've trapped a few times on our wildlife management areas, Mount Mason Wildlife Management Area. Mm-hmm. Trapped a few turkeys off there. So I've been involved in a lot of restoration projects, which was, you know, as I told Steve coming up here, hell, I'd have probably paid to do that work rather than paying me.
Man.
I understand
that. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It was a good life.
That's great. You know,
met some great people.
You know, I say it for us all the time, but you're even a greater story than we are, honestly. Mm-hmm. When you can make a difference in what you love with your work and your life, that's a great life, and boy, you can say that in spades.
Well, so I've been fortunate.
My hat is off to you.
Tell them about the first time you saw your first turkey and where it was.
Well, I had already gone to work for the Game and Fish, and we were over in Sharkey County around Rolling Fork. I forgot what we would. I was over there far, but anyway, I was one of the conservation officers was riding me around and showing me, and that's where I saw my first wild turkey.
Wow!
And it was a big old gobbler, and it just hit me that that's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life.
Hit the horn.
Chill bump.
You know what? That's exactly the same thing I thought the first time I saw one, too.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly, yeah.
And honestly.
It's a common thread.
Yeah, right now, it's still.
Oh, yeah, still is.
It's unbelievable.
And Mr. Benny, you've hunted every Mississippi turkey season that has existed, right?
Well, since I've been able to hunt, I started in 1970.
Wow.
And I hadn't missed a season. I went one season, I didn't kill a turkey in Mississippi, but I killed some turkeys elsewhere. I've been fortunate enough. I've hunted in 15 different states.
Yes, sir.
And, and if the Lord don't take me up before next week, I'm going to go again.
We're getting after it. I love to hear that.
Excellent. It's in Florida.
Tell us the story about, isn't this your first turkey right here?
The one on the left.
Yeah.
Is, that's the first turkey I ever killed, and my buddy Wendell Neal and I were hunting at Zama, Mississippi, which is in Itala County. And some crazy reason, that turkey came up to me, and, you know, I sounded like a yard chicken, I'm sure. Yeah. But anyway, that was my first turkey, that one on the left right there. The ones laying down were killed. I think that pair was killed probably in the around 2000, you know.
That's and what great. Year was your first bird?
As in 1970.
It was in 1970.
Yeah. I like the way you got them standing up. That's how I was taught to do it. That's you would put them in a bookcase or something, mm-hmm. and force them to stand up,
right.
and they would dry like that.
Yep. Yeah, I'd put him up against a bookcase and put a brick on him.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
When we got him out of the windowsill this morning, his wife, Miss Betty, said they've been there since about 50 years.
Yeah.
Wow. In that same spot. And in that back room where he's got, there's about 500 beards.
I tell you what.
You're making me feel special and over. That actually was my same first year as 1970.
It was?
Yep.
Wow, look at that. And were you the Spurs this big on your
No, head? It was a Jake. Yeah. What spurs?
Yeah, this.
Those look like spears.
That's some of the biggest Mississippi spurs I've ever seen.
How long are those?
I don't know.
They big.
Actually, mine was in January, believe it or not. Fall season.
Fall season.
At down in Alabama where I grew up.
But they
always
on.
Had a fall season. No, Mr. Fox did.
Yeah, there you go.
January.
That's great.
I asked him when we were on the way up here, too, what was the first shotgun you used and what was the. You need to hear this story. So,
well, the first five turkeys I ever killed, I had a Sweet 16 with a 26 improved cylinder.
That'd be a Browning Sweet 16.
Yeah. Browning Sweet 16 because I quail hunted.
Oh, yeah.
That's the only shotgun I had.
Yeah.
So the first five turkeys I killed, including that right there, was killed with a 16 gauge Sweet 16 7.5. Birdshot.
Wow. Improved cylinder.
Improved cylinder.
Yeah, they were close.
What was your
distance? It was a fixed cylinder. It wasn't no screw in.
Yeah,
joke.
Yeah.
What was your distance you would set? I know you'd always set a
distance. I had a mark of 30 yards. Okay. If I could get him to 30 yards, mm-hmm. I could kill him.
Mm-hmm. Kill him.
Wow. You know, that's the thing. Diddy had a Model 12 with like a 30 2-inch barrel and no vent rib and just a smooth old.
Straight by.
It barely has a couple of serial numbers he'd gotten from someone in the family. And that's he's 44 is when he killed his first one. But he never missed a turkey with that gun ever and shot it all the way to the mid-60s. But he was shooting 2 3/4-inch sixes.
Mm-hmm. Sixes.
Always. Sixes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he got his first. He was so excited they came out with the 3-inch Magnum.
Remington. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he was so excited. And the first turkey he ever missed is the first one he ever shot with the new,
really?
You know, the new big bullets, you know. But he, I said, how'd you never miss one or not? He said, well, I mean, I had that 30 yards was his distance.
Yeah.
He said, if they weren't at least 30 yards or less, I never, ever took a shot.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of folks sighted their shotguns in back then. You know, folks just assumed it was.
You didn't think about patterning the gun. No.
That's right. I remember my dad handed off his old 870 to me, and he told me to just aim at the base of the neck.
Yep.
And I found out why when I sighted it in, it was over a foot high at 35 yards.
Wow. Yeah. Maybe you had to aim a little lower.
Tell them what you shoot now.
Well, I shoot a 3.5 with TSS.
Man, I hear you.
Goodness gracious.
Because they don't make fours.
That's right.
Well, you know, you can. We need to introduce him to a 20. That thing,
Bobby,
change your life.
I know it's all sporting and people are shooting them with 410 and stuff now, but
that's right.
The conservation minded thing is be sure when that's you pull the trigger, they go down
right.
You don't wound them. And so, kudos to him.
You're right.
That's right.
Wanting to see them flop.
And I've got questions in my mind, but dang, Steve, you just keep laying the good questions out.
Steve said, I know what.
Yeah, I've heard this story.
He's so famous, he brought his handler with him.
Mr. Benny, I want to ask, you mentioned Wendell Neal a minute ago, and I just hear his name pop up all the time with Ricky Flint.
Yep.
Post stuff about him.
Let me give you a little history on Wendell Neal.
Please.
He was a graduate of LSU, bless his soul.
and he overcame it. That's great.
But at any rate, Wendell started in April before I did in May. And he, at that time, was assigned to the Deer Project. And he brought Mississippi along in managing deer herd. And he was very good at it. And, of course, at that time, you got to remember now, if you mentioned shooting does, you were sacrilegious.
Oh, my goodness. It was,
That was his job. And he didn't pull any bones about it. He was good, and he would tell a hunting club, okay, he'd go there, and he would examine their deer and their records. And he'd say, okay, you need to kill 60 does. Well, God almighty knows. You can imagine what kind of stir that brought about.
It was just.
But that's where he made his mark. And he didn't retire from the game and fish. He left the game and fish and went to work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And while he was with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is where he learned the Endangered Species Act and how to apply it with some common sense. And that's where he got to know Ricky Flint. They hired Wendell after he retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to do the alligator management plan for the state of Mississippi.
Huh.
Wow.
And when I mentioned that after I retired from the Department of Wildlife, I went to work with Endangered Species Consulting, and that was Wendell Neal's company. And he and I worked together for 11 years after I retired, and I probably learned as much from him about bird calls, how to identify birds by call, identifying plants. You know, if you're a deer biologist, you got to know what deer eat.
Mm.
Same thing with turkeys. You got to know what they eat. So he was a very influential guy that did a lot for the not only the state of Mississippi, but for the United States, because he was a national biologist with Fish and Wildlife Service. He's very good at interpreting and applying the Endangered Species Act with some common sense.
Were you with him when I hear a rumor that a hunting club pulled a gun on him when he was talking about the shooting doe?
Oh, absolutely. His life was threatened many times, and I'm not exaggerating that, because of his stance on deer management.
And they would just say,
they'd get fighting mad.
Yeah.
Well, it's an important lesson for us and our listeners to hear is that, you know, oftentimes these biologists and scientists come up with these ideas that we think are crazy at the time, but I think it helps to listen to what they have to say.
Well, it behooves us to, you know, of course, most all decisions concerning wildlife have a political side to mm-hmm. it. And that's good up to a point. But when you get down to making the final decision, you need to look at the resource first and the political aspects second. And a lot of times that's hard to do.
There it is. You got to have some horns on that one.
I'd like to say every commissioner of every wildlife group in every state needs to listen to that statement he just made.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
He told me on the way over here, too, some encouraging thoughts about the Mississippi Delta and where he thinks it's going with the Mississippi turkey population. And I want him to kind of share about that because I think that might fire up some folks in the Delta to hear what he thinks where we're headed with and why.
Well, the Mississippi Delta, as you all well know, when you get to the levee over there and you go across that levee, man, things are great. Mm-hmm. But from the levee to the hills, of course, that's agriculture country. And at one time, there's practically all of the turkey habitat was destroyed there, to clearing it for agriculture. Well, in the past 10 to 15 years, the trend has turned a little bit that land that was not profitable for farming is being put back in trees. And as a result, there is going to be numerous places in the Mississippi Delta that you're going to have available turkey habitat, and they will have turkey hunting there again, or beginning to have it already. So there are some bright signs along those lines.
I tell you what, you know, we've talked about riding to the Delta, seeing some of those hardwood reestablishment zones and everything else, actually getting some few years on them. It's really promising over there.
It's very promising. Mm-hmm. And while I'm not a huge fan of the spacings and some of those things that I see, I'm glad that they're being converted over to wildlife habitat.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Yeah.
You know, used to, you would drive through and it would just be nothing but row crop everywhere you look.
Yeah.
And now there's a lot of areas where there's trees growing.
Yeah. You're going to have some habitat coming about there. Yeah.
So in your duties as a biologist, did you ever do any law enforcement?
Yes, sir. Most all biologists at that time were sworn law enforcement officers. And that was a good thing the way we looked at it, because if we were in a county helping doing a project and a conservation officer need help doing his work, he could call on us. Mm-hmm. And consequently, when we needed something from him, he was more apt to do it if we helped him. So it was a give and take situation. But yes, I was a sworn law enforcement officer.
So where I'm trying to go with it, when y'all were releasing these turkeys years ago, were there areas of the state where y'all were just like, boy, we need some help up there. These turkeys aren't going to make it. And where they were just maybe more poaching pressure, I guess, might be a way to describe it.
Well, there's no instance comes to mind that we needed additional law enforcement effort to protect the turkeys, because we tried to make sure that there was enough habitat there and enough people had joined in to say, okay, we're going to protect these birds, that we never assigned extra enforcement efforts where we released turkeys, to my knowledge.
I was kind of expecting him to say Itawamba County and some Wallaces or something like that.
Oh, come on. Always got to drag me to the woods. We know who the real outlaw is, Bobby.
Well, you know, if you look at the harvest map now on turkeys in the state of Mississippi, northeast Mississippi leads to
no doubt about it. There's a lot of birds.
Speaking of northeast Mississippi, I got to call out to one of our locals that I grew up being friends with, Jerry Hazelwood.
Oh, I know Jerry well.
Yeah, and so he went to Iuka. He moved back up there, but he actually was involved in a lot of this also.
Yes.
I just made me think of him because he was a biologist. When he transferred to being a biologist, he could still write you up.
Yeah.
But he, we let them come back down here and let y'all trap on us several times too. Yeah. They actually trapped over 60 in one flock.
After they got reestablished here?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, that's cool.
Yeah, we gave back. We trapped them a couple times at the cotton mills, a couple times at Cottrell Lake out there too. And Jerry was always involved in that too. But he was a warrior for wildlife too.
Yeah, he started off as a fisheries biologist.
That's right.
Yeah, I hired him. And
how about that?
He converted to our moved to the game division, we called it, where he was a wildlife biologist, and moved up to Iuka and did some great work.
How many of y'all were there back then?
Well, at that time, I think from the 70s to the mid, maybe 80, 82, I think we had 6 or 8 biologists for the entire state.
Wow.
And then we begin to add more.
Yes, sir.
And at one time, you were, if you were a biologist, you worked the whole state.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the best things about my job, the time I worked there, I have at one time or another worked in every county in the state of Mississippi, which was
cool.
Great.
Wow.
Got to know the people, the wardens, you know. And then my original job when I was hired was the Dove Program Coordinator. If you remember, back in the time, 12 birds was the bag limit.
Yep, I do remember that.
And you shot half a day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my job when I was hired, all of the southeastern United States wildlife biologists formed a group to look at the possibility of raising the limit on doves. Of course, that's called, since it's a migratory bird, that is controlled by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife mm-hmm. Service. So we had to come up with a plan to provide the technical information to them that they would say, okay, you can raise the bag limit.
Mm-hmm.
Our original request was to increase it to 18. And my responsibility in the state of Mississippi was to make sure that we trapped and banded at least 4,000 doves every year so that we could use those band recoveries to determine what the population was, whether we were doing harm or not.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we now have a 15 bird bag limit and you can hunt them all day.
Thank you.
Yeah, that is good.
I love a dove, especially on the grill.
If it had been 18, Dudley would have never got a limit.
Yeah.
That's a good spot, though. 15 is a good number.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good bag limit. You get to shoot a little bit more,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Eat a little bit more.
Did all those biologists work on the turkeys together, or was there a specific turkey spot?
Of course, it was my job to lead the turkey project.
Okay.
But just like when a request was made from, say, like Smith County, they had a place down there that wanted to release the turkeys.
Mm-hmm.
The biologist closest to that area would go to make sure that all of the requirements were met.
The habitat. Everything
yeah, and then he would come, and we would go to the commission and say, okay, this is approved. Let's put it on a release list.
Hey guys, I want to tell you about the all-new Gunner Dog Bowl. It's designed for home and built for travel. It's customizable, leak-resistant, light on weight, solid on durability, and rust-proof. Like other Gunner products, they're made in Nashville and designed for everywhere.
Have you heard about the LS Gamekeeper Tractor Giveaway? That's right, we're handing over one of our Gamekeeper-used LS tractors, and believe us, the team isn't thrilled about saying goodbye. This powerhouse comes equipped with a front loader, belly mower, backhoe, and tiller, making it the ultimate camp tractor with unmatched versatility. It comes with a certified pre-used warranty straight from LS, and the Gamekeeper's crew has given it their stamp of approval. Don't miss out. Head over to mossyokegamekeepers.com to discover all the ways you can throw your hat in the ring.
I want to paint a picture real quick. So in about, you said the cannon net was invented for ducks in the late 50s. And when did we first use it in Mississippi?
Probably 68 or 69.
Okay. We'll go back before that then. So we got 82 counties for everybody listening out there. So how many, just, and it's just ballpark, how many counties do you think actually had turkeys in, say, 1960?
In 1960?
Yeah, before we ever.
If I can't.
Just ballpark.
I'm trying to remember. I think there were turkey seasons in probably 10 to 12 or parts of 10 to 12 counties at that time.
I just wanted to paint that picture for everybody now before, and we'll get to it at the end of this podcast, just as we're so spoiled and we're so lucky for the pioneers like him.
No doubt.
Especially him.
And
think about today. There was 82 counties. And there was entire states didn't have a season back then.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of work done in 10 years. The impact it's had is amazing.
What other states were folks actively, you know, trapping and releasing roughly at that time?
Most all of the southeastern states were.
Okay.
Still involved in trapping and restoration.
Was there ever any interstate transfer of turkeys that you know of?
Well, if it was, it was done illegally.
Oh, really? Because yes. I had always heard some of the turkeys from where you grew up, Bobby, had come from, like, Missouri. But who knows?
If it was done, it was done illegally.
Tell them about the domestic turkey situation.
Well, of course, prior to the 60s,
listen to this.
There was a heap of turkeys turned loose all over the state of Mississippi that were farm-raised birds, domestic birds.
Right. Yeah.
Because the thinking was, okay, if we put enough of them out there, some of them are going to revert back to being wild. Well, all we were doing is feeding critters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can't, if you're not raised in a wild situation, you don't know how to survive there. If you don't have that mother hen to teach, to lead those poults,
you're going to make it.
They can't make it.
I think folks are still unsuccessfully trying that with quail.
I've been fighting that battle all of my life. You know?
No.
And it just doesn't work out because if those baby quail, when they're hatched, if they cannot father that mother and learn what to eat, where to eat, when to hide, not to hide, they just can't make it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell them about Lafayette County.
Lafayette County, which is Oxford, as most of you know. Mm-hmm. I did
junior college up there, I think.
There is a college up there. Yeah, Rob went to it.
But anyhow, when I first went to working and put Lafayette County on the release list, there was a conservation officer up there by the name of Haroldine Prestige. And when I told him we were going to release them birds, he says, "Hell, boy, it ain't going to never amount to nothing. People see them turkeys, they going to kill them." I said, "Well, Haroldine, that's your job to keep them from killing." And plus, we've got this cooperative agreement with the U.S. Forest Service and the private landowners. We've got a big block, and they're going to provide protection. Well, he's still alive. And the last time I saw Haroldine, he's retired like me. He says, "Well, Benny, I'm going to have to, you told me when you released those birds that we'd go years and probably wouldn't see any birds, but one day we'd wake up and by God, we'd have birds all over the county." And he says, "And that's what happened."
There you go.
How about that?
Yeah.
Mac, you look like you got a question.
I do. So it sounds like the whole project was a success. What are some factors on a habitat that you looked at that you would attribute to that success, and then some things that they didn't work out well and why?
Well, our requirement at that time, of course, 10,000 acres minimum. And at that time, we thought probably 80% of that had to be quality hardwoods.
Hmm.
And, of course, that's because that's where we saw turkeys. But, as you well know, now a turkey is a very adaptable animal, and they can live in situations that I would not have thought they could have. And but most of ours, I can't think of one individual place that failed where we released turkeys because we made sure that there was adequate habitat and protection.
No. 10,000 acres is a big block.
There's going to be some good habitat in there.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, at that time, you got to remember, that was pine plantations were just beginning to come into being.
Mm-hmm.
Most everything you had was either mature hardwood or mixed pine hardwood, which was excellent turkey habitat. And you added a little protection to that, they had an excellent chance of surviving.
Yeah, probably no hogs either.
No hogs.
Yeah, and then my theory, and at the time I asked Dr. Hurst that. He agreed with me, but he was a big nest predator guy, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
But every time they release them somewhere, all those predators, even the, you know, whatever, a bobcat or coyote, they didn't have any experience with that as a food source.
No.
So they kind of got a
little boom.
Got off light a couple of years, and it just seemed like, our story – we got 10 turkeys, 10 hens. They wouldn't let us have a gobbler from Catfish Point. They said, "Just wait. We got a place in May. We're going to get you a couple gobblers." So on February the 15th, we got 10 hens. Now, We know for sure two of them got killed. One got caught by something. I don't know what it was, a bobcat or something. We found the feathers. And actually a mailman ran over one of them. So they were released out here on Cotter Lake. So we know for sure we didn't have but eight to start with. We didn't get our Jakes until May 2nd. And we know also for sure, one more data point, because we spent so much time out there and their forester biologists watching everything. We know for sure we had at least six successful nests from those eight hens, which is incredible. You'll never get that anymore today. And I just have to attribute it. It was great habitat. And there was a lot of grown-up fields with the big hardwoods and stuff, and a few early planted pines. It was that I know what it looks like now. But I just got to believe that the predators don't know for at least a year or two, and it gets them off to a great start. But that was an amazing thing. So the other thing, and going back to Dr. Hirsch, I relied on him and Daddy did. How did those hens get bred? February 15th, those Jakes were able. He said, no. Those Jakes didn't. They were already bred when we trapped them. And that's the only way it could have happened. Yeah. February 15th.
So you never came back and let any gobblers go? You did?
Yeah. We released two Jakes. They brought us, just like you said, y'all gave us two Jakes. But he said, no, sir, but those Jakes did not breed them.
Well, those hens were already bred, so they had no chance. But now think that a Jake cannot breed, because he certainly can. Mm-hmm. He's got viable sperm.
Yeah. I guess he spent enough time. He said, when we trap them by that date, almost always they've already been bred.
Yeah.
And that's amazing.
Interesting. Yeah.
How much fire was on the landscape during this time, Mr. Benny?
Fire?
Yes, sir.
Oh, at that time, it was considerable.
Yeah.
Because you didn't worry about your neighbor's land. He wanted you to burn. Mm-hmm. And, of course, all of that has changed now. Burning is still a valuable tool, but it was easier to do back then. A lot easier.
Now the quail population in Mississippi did not start to decline until 1966, if I'm correct. And so, if we're talking about the early 70s, there wouldn't have been much time for, a lot of that good habitat to disappear. So maybe that helped a lot.
Well, turkeys live now where I never thought they would. If you're, of course, most forest people now, it's just like farming. It's on a rotation.
Yeah.
And if you take enough time to leave travel corridors for those turkeys, because there's periods of time when pines are coming along that the turkeys are not going to use it. If they can't walk through it, they don't use it. And if you've got a corridor, whether it be a road or a streamside management zone, that they can transverse those plantations and get to available habitat, they'll still use it. And then when it begins to thin out and you burn it or thin it, then they will use those pine plantations.
Mm-hmm. Got to give it some connectivity.
Yes, exactly.
So, Mr. Benny, I want to ask you, let's go back to when you were learning to do the cannon nets.
Okay.
And I'd like for you to describe how you set up a cannon net, and then what all the effort it takes to get birds up to it. What's it like being in the blind, waiting on the bird and tripping through? That's got to be just as much fun as hunting.
Okay, of course, a cannon net. When you say the word cannon, that's exactly what it is. It was a piece of metal pipe. It was about 14, 16 inches long, and it, of course, had a projectile, and that projectile had a groove cut in it, and you used either black powder or modern powder, and you used a certain weight of it, and you put it in a balloon, and you taped it off or used a rubber band, and then you put that charge behind each projectile and slid it down in that cannon. Of course, you had the wire coming out of it. And you had a lead wire that went from one end of the net to your blind. And that's, of course, what you set it off with. But you had three of those. And you had the net, and you had to have the nets were they varied, but most of them were 20 foot long and 30 foot wide. Hmm. And and of course, you had to have a space big enough to use that. And what you would do, you would find a space where you could shoot that net. And you'd go to baiting the turkeys. We used wheat 90% of the time. and you would string it out from where your bait site, half a mile or a quarter of a mile each direction down the road. And then you would start checking it every day. And when they start using it, when they got to your bait site, you went in there and set up your cannons and your net, camouflaged it with hay, built your blind, and then you start sitting, waiting on them. And most of the time, you would catch them within a day, sometime 2 days.
Wow.
And, of course, they were coming to that bait. And, of course, with experience, you could look down that line, and when they were all feeding, or as most of them were feeding, you fired the net. And occasionally, you would have one or two that would escape, but not often. Hmm. Now, sometimes, particularly around behind the levee over there where you would have as many as 60 or 70 turkeys coming to the bait, when you got 30 or so under the net, if you could, you'd go ahead and shoot it because you couldn't handle more than that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about your cohort, what his job was as far as what you did.
Like Wayne Strider, of course, he knew that area down there, and he was well familiar with it, and he knew where to bait and not to bait. But anyhow, he, at one time, did most of it by himself. How he did it, I don't know. But anyhow, he finally developed enough confidence in me that he would trust me to come help him. And when we got ready to do the capture, he would get in the blind, and he'd put me in a pickup truck close enough to it that I could hear when he shot. And, of course, we would already have had the transport boxes loaded in the truck. And when I heard him shoot, of course, I hauled booty up there. Yeah. And we began to take them out from under there and put them in a box and put them in a truck. And then I would call, like if they were coming to Clay County, I'd call Mook or somebody and say, okay, we're coming here and we're going to go to this particular place. We'll put all of the boxes out in a row and open the boxes and let them all go at one time as much as we possibly can.
So after that net goes off, you just physically go out there and carefully get them out of the net?
You know, when the net goes off, those turkeys come up.
Yes, sir.
And they get entwined in that net. Mm-hmm. So what we did, we would take me and Wayne would get a turkey apiece and get him unwound, and then we'd go put him in a box, turn the box up so he couldn't get out, and then just work them like that because they'll get tangled up.
Oh, yeah.
And surprisingly enough, after they get tangled up, they got pretty docile. You know, I reckon they quit fighting.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But now, a big gobbler, when you got him out of that net, you better have him a hold of him because he was wanting to get away from her.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you carry him and put him in the box. And when you put him in the box, it's dark. And he calms down
when it gets dark.
Hmm. Yeah.
I bet that black powder going, I bet that's loud.
Oh, it's a boom. Yeah.
Sounds like dynamite going off. Yeah,
so, and it's shooting that net. So, and I guess sometimes there's probably some birds that you mentioned you want them all feeding. So, I'm assuming you want their heads down.
Heads down. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
That's fascinating how y'all learned to do that. I'm not sure. It seems like I've read where there was a guy maybe in South Carolina that kind of invented that process and it kind of spread around. Yeah.
Well, just like the first time I was helping Wayne set the net, you know, I was in my mind visualizing how were we going to elevate those cannons. Well, he had decided on his own that if he knelt down in front of that cannon and that he could look and that projectile would be looking right in his face, that's where he wanted the angle to be because that got high enough, that got over the birds. And, of course, they come up when it shoots. And he just figured that out on his own.
Hmm. So no sine, cosine, tangent, just height of the nose.
About right there. That looks good.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And then he'd hide by himself.
Yes.
And I assume he had some kind of button he'd push.
Well, he used a battery.
And,
you know, he'd take a small either motorcycle battery or something like that, and that's what you set it up.
That's how we would detonate beaver lodges and stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Boom.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow. Those are fascinating stories. Lanny, you got a question?
They kind of popped it on me, but let me think about that for a second. I was thinking about the cannon net.
You know, I could imagine there's probably instances where y'all touched the battery and it didn't go off, and then that probably
creates that makes you mad.
Yeah.
All that work and setup time, that's for sure.
That's kind of like, you know, setting up your camera and forgetting to put the batteries or, you know.
Yeah.
So y'all would go straight to the counties from the trap? I mean, just get in the truck and here we go?
Take off.
Nice.
Yeah.
So they actually
– Here comes the cavalry,
I don't know how often y'all did it, if the state used it, but they brought ours in on a small airplane.
Oh, really?
Because it was probably 2.5 to maybe even 3 hours, and they didn't want to wait that long. They want to get them back out immediately. Mm-hmm. So kudos to them to go into that. I'm sure if you went from, like, Cahoma County to South Mississippi, you'd put them in a plane every time probably.
Well, no, most of the time we did it by truck.
Really?
Believe it or not, yeah.
And I don't know why they brought them.
Very seldom. Occasionally, we would have to keep them overnight.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But not much. You didn't want to. Mm-hmm. You wanted to release them as quick as you could.
The Furminator is the industry's most versatile piece of food plot equipment, allowing plotters to do every step of the process, working the soil, adding seed and soil supplements, and compacting. From start to finish, with a single implement, it's hassle-free by design. Set it for the seed size and simply drive the tractor, and the Furminator does the rest. Check it out at theferminator.com.
Nosler is known for their bullets, and now they're making suppressors. Nosler suppressors are made for hunting. Adding a Nosler suppressor to your rifle will make you a quieter, more accurate, and more effective hunter. Protect your hearing and disturb less game with a Nosler suppressor. The time to hunt quiet is now. Learn more at Nosler.com.
When all this was going on, were there coyotes here then?
Oh, yes, sir. But see, believe it or not, coyotes, fox, bobcats are the least of my worry when it comes to predators on turkeys. Your nest predators, which are raccoons, possums,
skunks,
they are a worse deterrent on turkey reproduction than the big predators. Now, a big predator will catch a hen, but nest predators, like the three that I mentioned, are far worse.
Well, think about it. I mean, they'll wipe out a whole nest. That's like, what, 6, 8, 10, 12 in one fell swoop.
Exactly.
They catch a hen here, a hen there. That's not that they're not a problem, but the numbers decimated by a nest predator just by design is going to be 10 times, 20, 100 times more.
Yeah. Well, there's some new research. Yeah. I'll just go ahead and say it. Dr. Collier is stating that the nest predators, he's referring to them as nest scavengers, and that's – apparently, they are not nearly as bad as we previously thought, based on his study. So that may stir the pot a little bit, but I thought I would bring that up.
Well, I think his point was like the hen is getting killed off the nest, and then, you know, the
raccoons
nest
are scavenging the eggs that would not have hatched.
Yeah. So what are your findings in your life along those lines?
Like I say, the three main ones are the ones we named, you know, skunks, coons, possum. I can't believe that they are not a factor, particularly now, because at one time when fur markets were good, you know, you could people wanted to trap.
Absolutely.
But now they don't because there's no market.
Right. That's right.
So you think if you'll just walk and look on roads on your hunting club or where you hunt, look at the number of coon tracks.
Now they're everywhere.
It's amazing how fast they reproduce.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they've got to eat something.
We also interviewed some trappers a few weeks ago, and they said absolutely, you know, those species you mentioned are in much higher number than they used to be.
Yes.
So I'm going to quote, again, Dr. Hirsch, because that's where, I mean, I'll quote whoever I learned it from. But he had 7 areas in the state the year it would have been in the 90s maybe, that he had radio collared hens on, and they're all public areas and stuff. And so his numbers from that year, 92% of all eggs laid were eaten by a nest predator. Yeah.
Now that's tough to get by.
That's right. And so he said Now, of the and one of the things he made an impression about, because we talked about the more natural mortality of like a buck from a, being a year and a half old to becoming a 6 year old or whatever. Same thing about turkeys. It just impressed on me. Anyway, so he said, so you've got eight that survived. He said six of those eight will get eaten by something before they're 14 days old.
Yeah.
And that could be, again, he said in his findings, the raccoon specifically was the worst even at that.
Killing poles.
Yes. Hmm. But there were other. Then that started maybe a fox or a bobcat or something catching them. So he said, so that year, that's how tough it was. He had two out of 100 that would actually make it.
2%.
But the thing that struck me way back then, I've always just kind of like magic. He said the magic date is at 14 days.
Yeah.
He said the mortality rate of a 14-day-old poult that can now flutter up and get off the ground is not even 5% to become a 2-year-old longbeard.
Huh. Yeah.
So his point to everybody from what he found, at least back then, if you can just hatch them and get them to 14 days old, you've won the battle.
Yeah, when they can fly up to roost, their chances of survival increases exponentially.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Have y'all had any experience like the Midwest states where they do these big coon calling shoots? Like they go out with these electronic calls and during the middle of the day, and they'll kill 100 or so coons.
I didn't even know you could call a coon.
Oh yeah, it is. I'll try
some of that.
It's pretty. You need to check it out. I've seen some videos of that.
It looks fun, exciting.
Yeah, there's like coon trapping competitions around that we're all familiar with, but I hadn't heard of the calling.
I neither. Yeah.
There is noticeably more raccoons now than ever. Yeah,
no doubt about it.
Yeah. No market for their hide.
That's right.
And we're feeding them everywhere, too.
Yeah.
So that doesn't look like that's going to get better anytime soon, because it doesn't seem like there's more trappers wanting to get into it. Or in the fur market, it doesn't look like it's coming back.
Well, you know, people that still coon hunt, and we've got a people that still coon hunt.
Yeah.
You know, they love those hounds and they love to hear them. But, you know, when the market's good, there's a pretty good incentive for them to shoot.
Right.
Now there's not.
You know, when I was a kid, I coon hunted with a guy, and he wouldn't shoot the coons.
Most of them won't. Yeah.
We'd get to the tree and have all that fun, and he'd love on his dogs.
Yeah.
And then we'd go.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That was
coon
just,
chasing.
Yeah, it was.
That's what, Bobby, you ought to do that with turkeys. Just call them up and let them walk off.
I'd love for him to do that.
Yeah, we should. Well, yeah.
Mr. Benny, what do you think the wild hogs have had an impact on wild turkey habitat?
Certainly.
Yes, great question.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. You know, you can just look at the places that hogs occur and look at the area that they disturb and the food that they consume. So they are a direct competitor with not only turkeys, everything that eats acorns and seeds and bugs. They are a competitor with them.
No doubt about it.
I'm not so sure they own as bad or worse than the nest predator.
I mean, they're going to eat an egg if they see it. Yeah.
And I don't mean they go looking for nests, but you know they'll eat anything.
If they come across one,
they're going to eat it.
And they also frequent the sites that turkeys regularly hang out from about February to April.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And there's a conversation about them going through the – we've talked about this a lot, the small acorns that used to be left over.
Yeah.
They're going through like vacuum cleaners and getting them up.
The little small acorn red oaks.
I mean, the early turkey season, it was obvious. You could just count on them. They'd be in those big hardwoods, especially like willow water. Those small acorns that are last the winter, and that's where they're finding food before everything greens up, and it was just hardwood. And now there's it's like a desert where we have all these hogs.
Yeah. So, they're serious competitor.
Oof.
Bear Sears.
So, Mr. Benny, did you have somebody that taught you how to turkey hunt, or did you figure it out on your own?
Wendell Neal and I took it on ourselves to become turkey hunters, and you cannot imagine the mistakes we made. But they were learning mistakes. But we learned it on our own. And, of course, we got, you know, at that time when you begin to have mouth yippers, you know, we even would steal our wives' ashtrays and cut the aluminum pieces out and make our own mouth yippers.
Oh, wow.
I never thought about that.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever use the lead frame ones?
Yes.
That's what I started with.
Oh, yeah.
Old guy from Mobile, Jack Davis, liked those.
So you started calling them with a diaphragm?
Lead poison.
Well, the diaphragm, to me, was the easiest to use. You didn't have hand movement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've got an old slate that's nearly as old as I am. that I would not go without it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a friction call that's called a Big Jake.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
I had one of those, and it said Big Jake, Kilmichael, Mississippi.
Yeah, and I've used it so much, I've got a little groove in the lip.
That's incredible.
So I wouldn't go without it.
I lost mine. If there's any listeners that could help me find another one.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
And there's another person we need to bring into this mix. His wife, Miss Betty. I mean, she has let him go all over the world. He's got, I mean, in his house, tell them what skull you got in there. What's in the right corner over there, the skull?
Well, I've got a African lion skull.
Oh, man.
And a leopard skull.
Oh, man.
I've got a mountain lion skull. I've got a grizzly bear skull. But even, a black bear skull.
But even more impressive than that, the hippopotamus.
Yeah, I've got a hippopotamus skull.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
This mountain lion skull didn't happen to come from Mississippi.
There he goes again. Bobby is always looking to stir up some kind of drama.
He will know if there's is one in the state of Mississippi.
Yeah. If there is a mountain lion in the state of Mississippi, he or she was released from a cage. There are no native mountain lions in the state of Mississippi.
There you go, Bobby. Well, so you can cease the conspiracy theories.
How did that we get this like panther calling creek and panther calling?
Well, you reckon those came from the Indians. And there possibly were some mountain lions in this country in those days. But they have not been a mountain lion confirmed kill or sighting since the 1900s.
Bobby was just be so sure you said, oh, yeah, they are.
Yeah.
And it's killing him now.
Well, you know.
It's killing him.
Of course, as a biologist, people are going to tell you, well, I heard one hollering last night. Well, believe it or not, they heard something screaming.
Yeah.
But what it probably was a fox.
100%. Right. I agree with you there.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, they do make a crazy noise.
Yeah, they do.
Can you imitate that, Dudley, that fox?
It sounds like a screech. I mean, it's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mr. Benny, I've got a question. What was the black bear population like when you were doing this inside the levee?
Practically non-existent.
Hmm.
But that is changing all along. You know, we're getting more bears. They're being watched and radio tagged. And that's another thing that's going to make the Mississippi Delta so attractive is these additional areas that are becoming woodlands.
Right.
That is expanding the bear habitat greatly. So at some time or another, as those bear populations increase, we'll probably have a short bear season, which is great, you know.
Yeah, Florida had one.
Yeah.
We saw a bear. My son saw one 2 springs ago.
Yeah, in Knoxby County.
No, here.
Oh, really? I thought that was
it was at the Dad's place, buddy.
Ooh.
Yeah.
In fact, he took a picture of the track and sent it to Jason Redden here, and he said, that's a bear track.
Oh,
he said, well, I know. I saw the bear. It stood up on his hind legs. And it was a small one. He said that's the first official sighting in Clay County that they've known of. He said, but I doubt it sticks around. There's like been young males coming over from in Alabama all up in through here.
Yeah.
Here and there in different counties. But then they hadn't taken up residence that they know of yet. So
looking for a breeding opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
About that.
Steve, what are we not asking? You know all these stories. I would love to hear some old stories about trapping turkeys or releasing turkeys or catching poachers, or is anything, Steve, ringing any bells, Mr. Benny, that would be good stories?
Of course, you know, I can talk about trapping and translocating turkeys in my sleep because that was my life. But, you know, I don't know that part of the procedure is of interest to people. You know, at times, like when we were trapping on Woodstock Island, of course, trapping on Woodstock Island, you just don't drive over there. You got to take a ferry to get over there. So when we were trapping there, Wayne and myself and a couple of other guys, we would go over there, and after a few days, we would catch a group of turkeys. And, of It because of the difficulty getting over there, I would call officers from wherever the release site was approved to come to the Mississippi River Library on the other side, on the Arkansas side, because that's where you had to go in. And sometimes, you know, they would get impatient waiting on us, and they'd get hungry. And of course, they'd have to go somewhere and get something to eat. So when I would come across the ferry on the ferry with the turkeys and they wasn't there, of course, I'd get pretty aggravated. And, you know, never did lose any friends over it, but we had some discussions about it, that when they came to get turkeys, they were to be there. So things like that, you know, occur. That's just human nature. Problems you have to deal with.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Why don't you tell us the story of your first turkey? Take us back to what, 1970?
1970. My friend Wendell Neal and I were hunting at Zama, Mississippi, which is in Natalia County, right close to the Winston County line. And we had hunted, I think, maybe we were in our seventh or eighth day of hunting. He and I would, not together, but we would go to the same area. And I had been to this turkey, I think, 7 days in a row. And for some reason or another, he was on Bear Creek, and I was on the hill above it. And for some reason or another, when I called to him, he was still on the roost, he flew right to the ridge that I was on. And somehow or another, I killed him.
There's that sweet yelping you was doing.
You know, he hadn't paid me much attention up to then.
Hit him on the right day.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. But that was the first turkey I ever killed. And, of course, I got to my vehicle, and wasn't long, Wendell came up. And, of course, we looked at him and just, you know, just elaborated on how good a turkey he was. And I got home about 9 o'clock that morning, and my wife was not there. And I sat on the back porch of my house with that turkey in my lap until she got home about 11:30 so she could see it.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how proud I was of it.
Did you see him pitch to you?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Mm.
Yeah.
Ooh, gets tight. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah, I don't think that happens as much anymore, you know, like parading your trophy around.
Yeah.
Like, I remember my first squirrel taking it to both sets of grandparents.
Oh, yeah. We do that with our kids now.
Yeah.
We're young, for sure.
Yeah, if somebody shot a spike when I was a kid, say with the late 60s or even early 70s around here, they put it on the hood of their Bronco and ride around town.
Show everybody.
Yeah. My first turkey, I made the Canton, Mississippi newspaper.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Grandson of, you know.
Grabs his first gobbler.
We had that quite a bit around here.
Bobby, you want a story talking about Mississippians and how they are innovative in what they can come up and do. My son and I were hunting this turkey back in 2019, and we knew one of the other guys in there had boogered him up a couple of times. He shot at him and whatever. So COVID year come around, my son was playing college baseball, and they shut him down and sent him home, and we're hunting every day. So we're hunting this turkey, and I never experienced a turkey like this. This turkey would not roost in the same tree. He wouldn't do anything the same. He went down a different way. You try to call to him, he's not going to do it. And so we decided we were going to surround him one day. He figured it out. He got down in the creek. He walked the creek out of there. I mean, this turkey, I mean, and we just couldn't do anything with him. The last day of the season, we killed a bird we thought was him. It was his subordinate turkey with him. So the next year, my son's back playing college ball again, and so I don't even really go over there. I got a different place. And then 22 comes around. We put a camera out there, and I see that turkey, and I said, that's that dang turkey. Because what he would do is he had two gobbles. He had one gobble that he would gobble and say, it's okay for everybody to talk and do. And then he had one gobble when he did it. That was it. No hens, no gobbling for the rest of the day until the next morning. So we go out there that 22 season, and that sun gun does that stuff, and that's that turkey. So the last day of March, we lay eyes on him. We hunted him all this time. We ain't laid eyes on him. And he had 27 hens with him. Mm. So I told Landon, I said, I saw one of your podcasts not too long ago, and I said, you got to be where they're going to be. I said, he hadn't done anything like this before. We're going to go in there. So we went in there like duck hunting. We got in there so early that morning, we didn't say a word. You called to him when coming. So right about daylight, he's out there about 80 yards in front of me on the limb. So the hens did exactly perfect. They pitched down on either side of me, and he drops down right there, and he does like this, and he starts walking. He's about 50 yards, and he gets about 5 yards, and he just stops. And he does just like this. I said, you son of a gun, you. So it looked good, so I sent it. Well, when I sat down, there was roots, and I had to get on the side of the tree, so I'm turning like this. Well, that 3.5-inch magnum, when I shot it, it sent me back, you know. Well, I saw the turkey roll. Well, then I see Landon get up and start running. I don't see the turkey. He runs on out of sight. About 10 minutes, he comes back. He's out of breath. He's dead. You boogered him up. He got up this high, and he dropped, and he run, and whatever, and he got away. We looked for that turkey for 4.5 hours because we knew that turkey's probably 6 years old. Mm. I said, he's going to have some hooks. Devastated. We get in the truck, and we're headed back. I was in Lexington, Mississippi, coming back to Kosciuszko, and Landon just out of the blue said, Dad, I was at Mississippi State a month ago and heard some guys talking about a guy that supposedly got a dog that will track a wounded turkey. I said, no, that ain't right. that's just not right. So I said, well, I know a guy in Louisville that has got the best deer hunting tracking dog in probably the nation. If that's true, he'll know about it. So I called him. He said, I'm on my way to Kentucky right now, my son, or I'd bring smoke, and he probably would find it. But that is true. There's a man in Webster County that's got a dog that will track that turkey. I said, I need to get a hold of this man. So he about 3 hours went by, and he finally said, I got him. He can be there at 4:30. I said, 4:30 is better than no 30. So we met up at the gas station on 55. We went to Lexington, drove right in there, and there's a kudzu patch that ends up in that hollow where that turkey was. I told Lennon, I said, he's in that kudzu somewhere. We can't find him. So he comes up, and he's got a little Brittany Spaniel, a little dog named Oakley. We pulled right down there to where the logging road was, where the kudzu was, and he said, now look, I'll tell you when she gets on it, if she does, and then you just stand still. We went about 40 seconds, and that dog went left. He said, y'all stop. Dog went out there, and it made a circle. It came right back across. He said, she is on a turkey. Do not move. She goes out in that kudzu patch, and she looks like something going in the bowl of a down the toilet. She started about 40 yards, and then she's at 35, and then all of a sudden she disappeared, and when she come up out of there, she had that gobbler.
Oh, huh. My goodness.
Was it dead?
Yes, it was dead.
Yeah.
And it had some 6-year-old hooks on it. So I mounted that turkey. And
you love that dog.
I love that dog. we got pictures of that dog up there. And that guy, he's from Webster County.
Who is the guy?
Doug Burgess.
I have never heard of such.
You need this man's number, Bobby.
I was about to say that to you.
I know what you're doing. I'm going to beat you to that.
Lanny's good at finding missing turkeys. Several,
but, I mean, you know, you and I did. That's a great story, too. I forgot next time we tell stories. Lanny and I found one dead shot. Mm-hmm. Lanny found it, like, way out in backwater.
Yeah, he was
like way knee-deep backwater on a little log pile. That was amazing.
It's the same thing, though. I had to crawl up in the log pile. Yep. I actually just heard his wing.
Yeah,
and I was like, he's in there.
Yep.
And I had,
Lanny said he looked down. You can't see this on radio. He looked down and he looked and there was looking up in there. Yeah. And all of a sudden there was a kind of a cave looking spot under.
There's a hole in there.
And this turkey sticks his head out looking back at him.
Doug began.
He said he's helped with a lot of kids, you know, that kind of thing. So I went back down there to see what happened with a honeysuckle bush right in front of the turkey at daylight. And so it just took it all down into his breast. Didn't, you know, but he was, you know, he carried it and then he died.
Yeah.
But that was the biggest turkey that I've ever killed, especially in the state of Mississippi. And he was fixing to get lost over that. And that dog found that for me. Yeah.
That's the first I've heard of anything like that.
Yeah. He trained it. He trained that dog to track turkeys, from that standpoint. So, yeah, right here in Mississippi. Yeah.
Wow.
That would be a good breed for that. I grew up with a Brittany.
I did too. Sure did. That was my main bird dog.
Well, Mr. Benny, what are we not asking you that we should? That you, when you were riding over here, you said, boy, if these knuckleheads are got any kind of smarts about them, they'll ask me about this.
Well, I've got a couple of questions I'd like to throw out at you and see, get your reaction to
that. Uh-oh, here we go.
Well, it's just the trivia that we were, that you.
Yeah.
All right.
Today's trivia is brought to you by Sheffield Financial. Fuel your GameKeeper projects with financing for power sports, outdoor power equipment, and trailers. Begin your next conservation adventure at SheffieldFinancial.com.
So when we do a trivia question, Mr. Benny, we always play for somebody that's left a review, and they've got a chance to win a prize. And I would say with us answering the question, he's got a pretty good chance of winning this prize.
Bobby, I don't know about that. Oh, Bobby set us up for failure already.
We did.
Until he's forgotten more about turkeys than we'll ever know.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So, Matt, who are we playing for?
So real quick. So you ask one person a question, and now you've got one person asking four people a question.
Oh,
so
good observation.
Your odds are a little higher.
Yeah. Yeah, we so stacked the deck.
I understand that.
So y'all are jinxed it now, so there's no way we'll get it.
All right, so the prize is going to be the number three GameKeeper turkey vest, and you can use, if this isn't you, you can go to GameKeeperFieldwear.com and use podcast25 and get 25% off.
Wow, that's nice. A great deal.
Yeah. It's a really good deal. So, Mr. Benny, the guys behind the turkeys are playing for Hoosier GameKeeper. That's
Hoosier it. GameKeeper.
I bet he's from Indiana.
Look at Lanny.
Look at that.
Yeah. King Fu Lanny. All right, Hoosier, we're gonna try to win you a vest here. So
ready?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Of course, being turkey hunters, you know that you're required to report your harvest. The day you have it, you have to 10 p.m. that day to report your harvest on the app, the turkey reporting app. My question is, what percent of the people that harvest turkeys do you think report them?
That's a good one.
Yeah, because Lanny.
Why is it always about Lanny? Get a little self-reflecting there.
I've heard this quoted. I've
heard it too.
I think I remember.
All I can remember it is alarmingly low number.
Yeah, I think it's a low number too.
I think
38%.
I had 36 in my head, so that's close. I remember Ricky venting to us about how bad it was year one.
You said 36, you got 38.
Flip-flop that, I think.
But I'm going to go.
I'll trade with you. I'll take 36.
I'm going to go 27.
Oh, y'all don't have any faith.
I'll go 39.
I'm going to go 60, even though I'm not even in on this.
You're in on this. I feel
good about the Mississippians reporting their turkeys.
Mm-mm. Well, you'd be disappointed. The information that I have is that the reported harvest on the app that you're supposed to use with your phone is about 40%. Of the harvest.
Toxic.
So, you know.
30, Bobby cut me off.
39. Fair, right?
39. And, yeah, but you didn't have the right.
Course, you know, that's kind of disappointing.
It is disappointing.
Yes. Well, and then I have another question to ask you that's related to this. As you know, starting in 25, turkey hunters will have to tag their harvest.
There will be
a physical tag issued, and you will be required to put it on the turkey before you move it.
That's right. You cannot even pick it up and carry it out of the woods.
This is hot off the press.
My question is, do you think that will increase the amount of reported harvest, having that physical tag having to be on it? Do you think that will make any difference?
I hope so. Yeah.
Personally, I do. I've been a huge fan or proponent of that.
Yes.
I've heard great reports from the other states.
So I do believe it will help our officers enforce it better. That I do believe. So if there are suspicion people, and you know, it's just so easy for somebody to avoid it, you know, on the phone app deal. But if you, in any way, shape, or form, have a turkey in your possession without the tag on it, they can get you now. So I do think it'll help. Some now the void between the reporting, I don't know. I hope it improves. I just hope people realize how valuable that information is.
I know it's the only way to make decisions.
Yeah. Well, but I do think it's going to help them be able to enforce it better. Yeah.
What do you think, Mr. Problem Benny?
Yeah, what do you guys think?
Well, my opinion is that the guy that won't use his phone to report is not going to put the tag on. Mm. Now that's my opinion. So if he's already doing it wrong, I don't think he's going to change.
No, I'm not.
If you're on the borderline, and then particularly if you've got an officer or officers in the county that are checking. Mm-hmm. Now, that may influence your thinking a little bit about, well, now, if I walk from here to my truck and there's an officer sitting there and I don't have that tag on that turkey, I'm automatically in violation. Mm-hmm. So I see that as a plus.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is hard. I mean, they started in Alabama too, and that's where I do most of my hunting, Alabama and Mississippi. But you have to train your mind to remember to do it. We've never done it a whole life. Right. So you go to somewhere like Texas, and everybody out there knows you don't move them, not an inch till you put that tag
Get
on.
Get the tag on.
And so we're used to doing it out there. And people have got to – I don't know if
– I wonder how they're going to make it
I
work,
would respect
though.
His opinion on that, I hope. Hmm. But I do think even if no more people actually tag them, I do believe it's going to be – there'll be more opportunities to enforce it now.
There will be.
Yeah. So that's one good thing. I think especially – it seems like from listening, and I don't know this at all. You would know more than me. A lot of the problems with illegal harvest are like just like kind of here and there, and it'd be individuals that are a huge problem, more so than a bunch of people shooting one over the limb or something. There's just out of control people have no respect for the resource. And it may help them with people like that. You know.
Well, hopefully it will, because, you know, the average turkey hunter in Mississippi – harvests about 1.5 turkey per season. Mm-hmm. So those people you don't worry about. Mm-hmm. It's the ones that exceed the limit excessively.
Yeah.
Is the ones that hopefully anything you do that deters that will be a help.
Yeah.
So if I guess we'll go and we'll buy an additional turkey stamp in addition to our license, and that will include the tags. Is that the
well? My understanding is that if you purchase a license, if you turkey hunt, then you will have to. I think the tags will be provided.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But there will be a turkey tag. Now, my next question, or get your opinion on, is. Toxie mentioned that there should be a turkey stamp available in by 25, maybe 26. So my question is, do you think turkey hunters will fully support that or not?
I think fully support the turkey stamp.
Well, it doesn't.
Just from our limited.
I think a vast majority will. Will everybody? No.
Doesn't it earmark the dollars to go directly for turkeys, right? I mean,
that's just like a stamp.
Yeah.
So these things aren't mutually exclusive. Like, I don't buy the stamp to get my tags. My tags will come with my license. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
That's my understanding.
Yes, sir.
That's usually the way it works.
I'm looking at the bill right now. Actually,
there you go. What does Bill say?
So it made it through the Senate yesterday, Toxie?
Yes.
Yeah.
Toxie, are those your wife's glasses or are those yours?
I've read some negative comments about the new stamp.
Bobby, did you
say
anything?
You have?
Folks just saying like, oh, it's just another tax we got to pay, you know, for our free resources.
I don't mind paying tax when it goes to wildlife.
I agree.
I probably don't need to be reading this bill out loud, but I do know who sent it to me to get some help and all said, I won't even call his name, common friend. We're having a bill introduced for Mississippi turkey stamp, and this will go with a physical tag starting 2025.
Okay.
And it mentioned that that's also going to go back to turkey conservation.
Yeah.
Great. So you buy the stamp, you get your tags.
Yes.
Gotcha.
I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's public knowledge right now. You can probably go online somewhere and look it up.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't need to be the one passing it along to people and reading it right now.
It's a step in the right direction, I believe.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, we'll learn more about it.
Right's right and wrong's wrong.
That's right.
Definitely a step in the right direction. Mr. Mitty, do you think our season dates and our bag limits across the South are where they need to be, or do they need to be tweaked a little
now,
bit?
This is my personal opinion, you know. To me, we have too long a turkey season. The reason I say that, because the methods of turkey hunting have changed so much that we have all-day hunting, and from March the 15th to May the 1st.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's what, March 7th now with the youth, right?
Well, including the youth. Yeah. I usually don't include them, mm-hmm. but you really should because, but what I'm getting at is that the methods of turkey hunting have changed so much because now the preferred method of turkey hunting is getting on the edge of a field in a blind and put out a spread of decoys. Mm. And if you have to, stay there till noon or all day. So that has increased the turkey haulers tremendously. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't have any problem with that, but where do you stop that? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you've got a shorter season or maybe quit it at lunch, then you reduce the harvest.
That's right.
Now, reducing harvest does two things. It gives everybody kind of an equal opportunity, and plus it allows more gobblers to go into the older age class. And that's where the real challenge is, harvesting a 4 or 5 year old gobbler. Mm-hmm. Now, he's seen it all.
Mm-hmm.
So you got your work cut out for you there. Well, so, now those are personal opinions.
Yeah, sure. Well, Dr. Chamberlain has verified that having a higher gobbler to hen ratio, in other words, just killing all our gobblers and only having a few to breed, is really a big headwind to raising more turkeys.
Yeah.
And you're going to be a lot more successful if you let more gobblers, you know, if you manage to where you have a higher percentage of gobblers there. In fact, I will say, you know, kudos to the state of Alabama, and I think more follow. Right, wrong, or indifferent, they're just sending a message. We're going to do what's best for turkeys, even if it's a little inconvenience.
Yeah.
That should be the main point.
That's right. The resource comes first. So if they move the season back 10 days, whether it's the right thing to do or not, I'm not here to argue, but they made a sacrifice on all our behalf. And then for the first 10 days, you can't use a decoy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what they're saying is that's 20 days longer. And they do believe there's a much higher likelihood you won't harvest as many of the boss gobblers with the big harem of hens.
Yeah.
Because the research indicates harvesting that turkey early in the season is a big detriment to raising a lot of turkeys. So, I mean, right, wrong, or different, I'm just saying I applaud them for taking steps they believe are in the best interest of the resource. I'm fine with that anywhere we got to hunt.
Yeah. Great. And as far as our bag limit in Mississippi, 3, I mean, that's a plenty.
Yes.
I mean, if you can harvest 3 turkeys in a season in Mississippi, that's great, but that's enough.
Yeah. If the research is proven that we need to back it off, we'll do whatever we need.
Well, and he brings up a good point, too. We're more effective than we've been before.
Much more
so. With TSS.
The calls.
The call, everything. Yeah. The camo.
Yeah, everything is advanced.
So I wish we knew accurately the harvest. That's sad to know. We don't even know, but we think that maybe only 40% of them even reported. So.
Yeah. What do y'all think COVID did to that hunting season?
Oh, yeah, man, a lot of people go hunting there. Everybody was in camouflage.
It's like you were saying with your son. Yeah. We heard stories about the hunting clubs, guys that never turkey hunted, they were just sitting in shooting houses with a decoy.
Right.
All of a sudden, everybody's a turkey
hunter. Right. Yeah. Right.
And that's not what we think of when we think of turkey hunting.
Right.
Well, now, when you think of turkey hunting, of course, when I started turkey hunting, you went to a spot, you listened. If you were fortunate enough to hear one, then you tried to get within a couple of hundred yards, 100 yards of him. You sat down beside a tree. If he beat you, you got up and went home. Occasionally, you'd beat and you'd win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that was it. You had no decoys. You got camouflaged as good as you could and stayed as still as you could. And
this
day, that's how I turkey hunt.
Yeah, me too.
Same here.
But the average turkey hunter in Mississippi doesn't do it that way anymore. That has changed.
Yeah, good point.
So my biggest thing is not just, not even – passing judgment on that. Let the states decide what to do. Use not even as much how we kill them as how many. I mean, that's the biggest thing.
It's the number.
Manage to have an abundance of the wildlife that we love. Yeah. And then, you know what? We're going to hunt around that as much as we can and kill as many as is, good for them still. But I just keep in my mind is we're pushing so hard to be sure a big, healthy abundance of the stuff we love.
Yeah.
Because like quail taught me, man, we love quail hunting so much. My daddy quail hunted every day, and then we lost them. And I've always lived in fear that when I see turkey numbers going slipping, it's like whatever we got to do to have abundant numbers, that's what we need to do.
Mr. Benny, is there all these years of you turkey hunting, is there a good tip that you could leave us with that somebody listening to this could improve their turkey hunting by listening to a tip from
Mr. Get up and go every morning.
There you go. I love that.
Be determined.
That's right.
And I will do that this year.
Yeah. Thank
you. You know, the system is that you're making him do something that he doesn't normally do.
Yeah.
The hens go to him.
Right.
So what you're reversing that situation. And when you do win, it's worth every effort you put into it. Mm. And when you lose, you still had a good day.
No doubt about it.
Because you got up, you took a walk, you heard a lot of other birds calling, you saw things you wouldn't have seen if you had been at the house watching TV.
So, amen there.
You know, that's the best advice. If you're a turkey hunter, go when you can.
You just made me smile inside. Mm. That was awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Can you tell me another name for a pileated woodpecker?
Oh, no.
Lord God.
Well, there we go.
Amen. Yes.
he nailed it.
Yeah. Well, I was looking for Indian
Somebody
hen.
Somebody gets a prize.
Okay, that's be second.
Indian hen.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
There we go.
Yeah. Bobby, we're going to sit here and put him out, bailing you out of bad questions all day.
Yeah.
So I kind of wanted to go before we've been here a while, and Toxie's had to make a restroom break. We've all been in here. But you mentioned in your career you worked with the endangered species. We're hearing little rumors that there might be some ivory bills that have been seen in Arkansas or Louisiana. Have you heard anything about this?
Yes, sir. And it was reported by Cornell University, which is the premier ornithologist school in the nation.
They created the Merlin Bird idea.
But now, apply a little sense to that reporting. This was several years ago. I was still working with endangered species when that was reported. And it was reported in the Cache River in Arkansas. And this had been, I think, something like 50 years since there had been a confirmed sighting of an ivory bill woodpecker. And he claims to have heard one. So there was hundreds of thousands of dollars invested in research, looking, recording, trying to find evidence of that bird. There's never been any found. So I don't know what he heard, but it wasn't an ivory bill woodpecker, obviously, because one individual cannot last that long. It has to be a population. Right. And if you've got a population, somebody nowadays are going to see and hear those birds. So I'm saying they are not there. And the evidence backs me up.
That's a sad deal.
Yeah.
Lanny, what'd you learn? Anything?
You know, it just excites me to see a group of people like Mr. Benny, the impact they can have on the resource. I mean, when they all really got together, the cooperation between the landowners, the desire of the hunters, and they turned the wild turkey population around in Mississippi. And I mean, in a decade, is that?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
That's got to make you feel.
Yeah. I hope you feel good. We probably wouldn't be sitting here if that didn't happen.
Thankful to be here today because of a bird like that.
Yeah.
And of course I'm so appreciative that I was involved in that. I just happened to be a person in the right place at the right time. There are other people that contributed as much as I did, you know. And the guy that got those turkeys, he was just as important as me and Wayne sitting there catching the turkeys. Because it all had to be done in a sequence.
Well, you're a rare breed.
I'm an old breed.
Are you saying he's an endangered species?
I tell you, his style, his type.
And I'm going to stay on Toxie's line. Thank you for your service and what you've done.
Oh, my gosh. It makes me so... even more. I mean, I obviously get all carried away and get excited about what we do in our life, but it makes me so, on one hand, so deeply grateful because of people like you and people like you, but especially you here in Mississippi, but to do even more to do our job carrying on.
That's right.
And then even, I feel good about our younger generation right now, at least a lot of them around our group. They are so conservation minded, but it just makes me want to be sure we don't ever drop the ball on the gift you have given us here.
Thank you. Well, that's important. You know, if you can't pass it on to the youth, you don't have much chance.
No, you don't.
That's right.
Well, whatever it be.
Yeah. I bet you got some bottom land in your closet.
I do.
Yeah. I'll tell you what. I'd love to go spend a morning turkey hunting.
No doubt about it.
I would love to do that.
Well, some of my mornings are pretty long. Some of them are very short.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm still, if I go and don't hear a bird, you know, I'm back to the house, piddling in the garden or cutting the grass or whatever.
Oh, man, that's my own heart right there.
No doubt about it.
That's the way I turkey hunt.
Yeah.
Well, Bobby, you see the reason why I wanted you to sit down with him.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. I mean,
he's some knowledge that we still have that I just hadn't heard this put out there.
No, and an inspiration we all need.
Yeah,
you know, because it's easy. It's easy for without this landmark to listen to. It's easy to take. It's easy for all of us. It's easy for me to take it for granted.
No doubt about it. Yeah.
But it forces me. I did get to live, fortunate to live because of Daddy lived through the history of a lot of this, and it just makes you go back, and then you just, what, you know, good gracious.
This is the prequel to Mossy Oak to me. Lucky. I mean, this is the story. Is. That, you know, I mean, if that's this hadn't happened, I firmly don't believe we'd be sitting around this table right now. Yeah. So,
no doubt.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, we're fixing it. I guess I can't talk about that.
You can't talk about that. Something cool is coming.
Yeah, it's only in
get
the
ready. Day,
but the weekend after this, so we will be the most monumental film we've ever produced at Mossy Oak will be released. But I can't say anything else than that right now.
Yeah, that's all.
We'll talk about
that's
it.
That's all we're going to say about that.
When he cuts my
That's a pretty big teaser.
Yeah. It's going to be incredible. Yeah,
wow. It's legendary for sure.
Well, Mr. Benny Herring. We just salute you. We thank you. We
appreciate you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And thank you.
What's your wife's name? Miss Betty?
Betty.
Yeah. Well,
Miss Betty, too.
Look, yeah, absolutely.
I married way above my status.
Yeah, we all did.
Me, too.
She was like me. She grew up poor, working hard, educated herself, became a great teacher. And of all of the, I mean, I've been gone a lot, be gone a week at a time. I've been all over the world, fortunately, hunting. And she has never the first time complained about it.
Wow. You know,
that's a winner right there.
I'm telling you.
As my daddy would say, we need to get a pint of her blood and spread it out amongst the masses.
That's right.
Yeah.
But yeah, she was my main supporter.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. Well, guys, look, we appreciate everybody listening to our podcast, leaving reviews. Mac, you look like you got something you need to add to the.
So we just came out with some new T-shirts.
Oh,
and Dudley's got one of them on.
Yes. Listen, learn, and enjoy. Hey, we got some new lids too.
I know.
Got one on.
Pretty sharp.
New lids.
This is a podcast T-shirt. It says listen, learn, and enjoy.
Yeah,
that's kind of what we did today.
That's
Amen.
Great.
It's GamekeeperShop.com. That's right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mac. Appreciate you doing that.
He always keeps us on track.
He does. Yeah. And so we appreciate everybody listening. And it's so much fun to bring stories like this and make sure people get to hear
this
about
this. This is my favorite one. I'm going to go on and say it right.
It's a good one.
This is a good one right here.
Yeah. It's so good, we're even going to let Lanny buy lunch today.
All right. Let's do it. I love lunch.
All right. Why don't you say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley.
Get us out of here, Rob.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast. And be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife Magazine. And don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt Podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.